Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today we'll be talking to Arnab Tessiador as part of our mini-series on green jobs. Today's episode is hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare. Arnab Tessiador is a programme officer for the Ecosystem Resilience and Spatial Planning programme at the IUCN Centre for Mediterranean Cooperation. He coordinates a portfolio of projects with a focus on sustainable tourism and visitation of protected areas. With a background in spatial planning, Arnab has worked for over 10 years on sustainable development initiatives relating to tourism, nature conservation, transport and climate change in several countries, including Turkey, United Kingdom, Switzerland, and now across the Mediterranean. Arnab is from Girona, Spain, and holds an MSc in International Planning, Spatial Planning and Sustainable Development from University College London, and a degree in Architecture and Urban Design from the Universitat Politecnica de Catalunya. Welcome, Arnab, to the TSL podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about your current role and the background to your work and how it relates to sustainability, and also what motivated you to work in this field.
Well, I think that's going to be a long one. So currently I work for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, an NGO international organization working globally, and it's a union of governmental members and NGOs and indigenous groups trying to kind of set up standards and methodologies to understand the status of biodiversity and nature in the planet, and also find ways to safeguard it. Specifically, I work in the Center for Mediterranean Cooperation, that is an office based in Malaga, and we work across the Mediterranean basin, so Southern Europe, Northern Africa, and Western Asia. And my role is mainly as a program officer, managing projects that are related usually to protected areas, tourism, and spatial planning. So at the end, we are trying to work with partners, as I mentioned, sometimes governmental, sometimes third sector, sometimes private sector, at improving their practices, their policies, and trying to, from there, to learn things that work, and then there can be learnings into our standards or the ways we work, or that can be recommendations, you know, for policymakers or for third sector organizations to improve the way they work. So, for example, we work in tourism in private areas, and then we're trying to understand what are the impacts, how we can measure them, how we can find ways that the different stakeholders around a destination, you know, especially when it's a nature-based one, understand their role, their impact, and how they can, you know, work better, you know, to preserve the destination, have a good socioeconomic impact into the communities. And then from there, see at the one side how we can then make these destinations more visible to the marketplace and kind of like create links with the private sector. At the same time, how this can inform, you know, other destinations and how they can work better. This could be an example, you know, of a type of work that we do at our office. Obviously, we're in a context in the Mediterranean where tourism is a big driver, so it's a big economic sector. IUCN adapts within the same strategy the priorities according to the needs and the main sectors, or the contextualization, let's say, to the regional realities.
Sounds very complex. Lots of stakeholders involved.
Yes, actually, yeah. That's probably one of the challenges, no? When working on sustainability, it's no longer, you know, like something that you can do away in isolation, but requires quite a lot of interactions between different actors and stakeholders. And it's not always easy, you know, to find the right angle to make everyone interested, to get the buy-in, and to ensure that there is everyone can see themselves in the picture and contributing into the same process. So that's one of the challenges, but also is one of the most beautiful part, let's say, of this type of work. Now, at the end, you are working, you know, cross sector, covering different themes and different type of actors and organizations, that makes it very rich.
What different ways or techniques do you use to engage the different stakeholders that you're working with? Obviously, you're working with scientists, with government, who use a very different language and communication style to perhaps local fishermen or local tourists or villagers that are living in the areas that you're working in?
Maybe just going back to your first question about the background. So now I'm working more in an office-based role and working probably more in project management and policy. But back in the day, I lived many years in Cabo Verde in Western Africa. And there, probably like this type of challenges, let's say, were more evident, no? Because we're doing a bit more of an implementation on the ground role. And definitely, yeah, as you mentioned, at the end is trying to understand the motivations and the interest and the goals that each stakeholder has. So obviously, a fisherman has concerns about their livelihoods and about how the context is changing and affecting their work in the future. So there is always a sustainability concern. Governments have their a more statutory role and a bit more conservative in a way on what they can do, no, within their mandate and the politics, no, that are behind their work. Communities at large, are always a buzzword, no, that it's hard sometimes to unpack, what it means, who is a community, who is not, who represents them, how they approach it, who has legitimacy, to approach them. So it has a lot of nuance depending on the actor and also depending on who you are. No? Like if you are, let's say, a small NGO, community-based, the way you are approaching your stakeholders is different if you are coming from an international organization or working there. And it's always like trying to understand, like your role, who are you representing and how best you can serve, the mission that you're doing, and the mandate that you have from your own organization.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder how much do the young people in the areas that you're working in have the chance to feed into the work that you're doing? Is the youth voice something that the IUCN considers within the projects they're working in, or is it more sort of the adult communities?
Yes, that's a very good question. So obviously, comparing more on the ground work, where in a way it's easier, the engagement with youth. And in many cases, developing educational programs for schools or for high schools, or trying to ensure that people in their formal educations and in their kind of out of school activities start to get engaged, into caring for the planet. And when you're working in a bigger, larger, more policy oriented organization, sometimes it's harder. Formally, of course, there is a commission working on. And education and communication and youth is one of the main targets. At the same time, we have our systems, to ensure that there is an understanding, on gender, on youth, on the different right holders and stakeholders that maybe are sometimes not as evident or they have a formal role and how to integrate them. But it's true that it's harder in a way to engage them in projects that are more policy oriented. I have to say. I think luckily in the last years, and obviously the influence of Greta Thunberg and also other figures here, for example in Spain or in other countries locally, that also have the voice of youth. And I think institutions have maybe in a slower pace managed to, every time that there is fora like the COPs, even if they can be criticized in many ways, when there is decision making processes, I think that every time there is more place, to hear voices from youth. And in our case, for example, we are developing in our center now as an initiative, kind of a youth reporter network. So it's a kind of like young people interested in communicating about nature conservation, sustainability. So we're trying to create these networks, create a community of young people across the Mediterranean interested in these topics. Obviously, generally, there is an easier access to these type of activities more at the local level. But I think there is many opportunities, especially I think when we think about more regional or supranational settings. No, I think it's a very, at least myself, I didn't have much of a chance when I was younger to engage in that. I think every time there are more opportunities to engage in this type of networks that put you not just in, let's say, in a new or that you can involve in activities that are related with your curiosity or with your desires or with your the thing that you want to do, but
passions.
Also, yeah, passions. Yeah, that's the right word. Thank you. But also the exchange, you know, like being able, you know, like sometimes we go to our life, maybe not having the chance to, you know, like meet people from across, let's say, in the Mediterranean, for example. You know, we have a kind of a melting pot of cultures, and you can see that this type of interaction that like makes you understand better, you know, how the world works, and that we are all more similar than we tend to think, but also there is different contexts and different priorities, and I think it's very nice, and I think yeah, it's a very commonplace, but that I think there is opportunities now to engage in this kind of more international or regional settings that are very interesting.
Definitely. I was lucky enough to attend the IUCN Youth Congress that took place in Marseille, and I know they had an online one earlier in the year. So it's great to see the global international levels being taken to involve youth by the IUCN, but also thinking about the very local projects that you're able to get youth working on as well, which is fantastic. So taking you back to your younger years, what would you say to your 16-year-old self? What's the advice that you would give to yourself now, having the career that you've had and learning the skills that you've been learning? What sort of advice would you give to young people that are looking to get to where you are now?
That's a great question. I think that my 16-year-old was quite lost in many ways. But yeah, I think... one of the few things I think I managed to do is to not be afraid of, you know, doing new things and saying, okay, I want to do something else. Let's do it and try it. So I didn't manage to explain much of the background, but I have been working. I'm an architect by training. So I work more in the built environment, and then moved into sustainable urban planning. And then from there, I moved to wider spatial planning issues, and then moved into protected areas, and then kind of like it all led to work in tourism and conservation. So this path in a way had always been kind of like exploring uncharted waters for me, but always trying to say like what I want to do, what I feel that it's fulfilling and kind of follows a bit my values, and not being afraid, as I was said, to do it. You know, saying, okay, I don't have the specific training, or I don't have the, you know, maybe the experience, or I don't have the network. I think all of this can be overcome quite easily. As I was mentioning, like with this idea of, you know, not feeling that you don't have the right conditions. So I think with myself, in a way, I have all this kind of imposter syndrome, no? That kind of like keeps happening, no? When you are in one place and you are in another one. And in many cases, I think if you are honest with yourself and you are honest about who you are to others, usually, like, you know, everyone understands, you know, like where you're coming from, and this can be overcome. So as I was mentioning, like one of the challenges is this one, you always feel like you are maybe unprepared, or you don't have all the right background, let's say, you know, to do a specific job or to get engaged into a specific topic. But I think in the end, it's a matter of will, and a matter of obviously hard work or at least work. So, you know, getting trained sometimes and, you know, by yourself, you know, like, or trying to connect with people that maybe can provide you with insight about sectors or about types of roles, type of needs that are happening, you know, like it's a very much of an evolving sector, you know, historically, or in many cases have been the presence of, you know, like people coming from more environmental science, biology, and maybe economics backgrounds were kind of more paramount. And then, but now, you know, like people working in finance, for example, is a very growing sector, you know, because there is many issues about how to finance, you know, carbon mitigation and climate adaptation, no? So we can see every time more people coming from a finance background engaging in sustainability and conservation. Also people that have worked in the private sector that can bring an understanding of how a specific, you know, industry works, no? And then understanding how change can happen in this organization. So in many cases, you know, like we are working with the tourism sector. So who can best understand, you know, how to deliver change in the sector than someone coming from the industry? So I think the start point can be any, like people working in anthropology, you know, and understanding how societies are related with natural resources. So I think in that sense, the field has opened widely, and this is like more academic, let's say, positions, but also I think every time, you know, like agriculture, the building sector and many others are engaging with regenerative agriculture and engaging with the need to make our built environment more efficient to be able to reduce emissions. So I think let's say sustainability has to become the business as usual. So in a way, from every corner and from every position, regardless of the academic level or the type of work, I think there is an aspect to it. Now, I remember when I was studying, I had a colleague from a social worker. You know, I was looking at the vulnerability of specific population groups to climate change. And obviously, social workers need to be aware of it, about the heat waves and about droughts and other type of phenomena that in a way can affect their work and that they also can be part of the solution, for having more resilient communities or to lobby or advocate, for better policies in climate. So I think the main takeaway in a way is that anyone from any starting point can engage into sustainability in their professional lives. And even if they don't feel in the professional life they are managing it, I think there is now in the UK, maybe more than other places, but I think anywhere now there is so many organizations doing amazing work at the community level, working sometimes more in a more, institutional context, sometimes working more in a more grassroots or self-organized, groups, buying cooperative, buying groups, another word in English, and many things that you can do with your friend, that you can do with, with your family, that doesn't require, joining an organization. So I think you can engage from more or less anywhere and find your way.
That's great. I think you raised some really interesting points there. I love the importance of being open to opportunities and not being afraid to take those, even if you feel like perhaps you have the imposter syndrome. Oh, I can't do that. I don't have that skill set. I don't have that qualification. I'm not from the right background. But actually reframing that with a positive attitude of, well, maybe I can. Let's take the opportunity, let's try, let's see where it leads. And as you say, everything is intersectional. Sustainability is integrated into so many different careers. You don't necessarily have to come from the traditional ecology conservation background. It can be green and blue finance, it can be architecture, it can be social work. It integrates into all of the different roles in our society. So I think that's really important to be open-minded to the opportunities, the skills that you might have that could be applicable, and the background or the passions that you have, and finding the sort of sustainability within those, rather than thinking you have to follow a set path and it has to be very green and conservation based the whole way. So I think that's really interesting. Thank you for raising those points. Thinking more broadly about skills, do you think there are any particular skills that have been useful to you in your career, not necessarily sustainability focused, but things that have really helped you that might be sort of broader and transferable skills?
I think definitely something had a lot of hype, the idea about the soft skills in a way are the ones that can make more of a difference. Now, obviously, many sectors require some formal training and sometimes have even regulatory needs, to do a profession or to do a specific type of job. But in the end, a workplace is a place when they make it about interactions between people, either from your team or from outside your team, people that you want to influence, people that you need to collaborate with. And I think I mentioned it before, but something I have learned through time is trying to understand very well your role and how you can make the most out of it, and try to look at yourself from, trying to take perspective on your role, let's say, and the role that your organization is trying to accomplish, and trying to kind of think about those. And then when you go out and interact with different people, stakeholders, even situations, it becomes easier. So I think that will be one that is a bit hard to kind of tag with a name, but I think this kind of awareness of the context, local context, international, your organization, your role. In many cases, it's easy to kind of get led by, your more pressing needs in terms of I have to do this, I have to do that, and just doing it rather than trying to think more strategically, because in many cases, we do a lot of things that maybe require quite a lot of, input that at the end maybe don't have so much impact, whether if you're trying to kind of be very mindful about the context, you can be very strategic about what you do and what you don't do. And maybe one that it's easier to kind of explain or to find a name, I think it's, let's say, professions or roles require a lot of organizational, like managing to be organized on the way you work, on the way you structure your work, on the way you communicate. It helps in any context, you know, like usually, like you can be a good worker in any sector and move, and then you're probably going to be a good, my worker is not the right word, but you're going to be a very solid professional in one role, and then you can move to another one. I think lots of the things are going to be similar, and in many cases are about that, not about managing to organize your time, because you know in knowledge roles, no, the amount of work that you can do usually it's kind of open ended, and you can always do more, you can always do something else, you can always do it better, no. So being organized and trying to see what can have the more impact, I think that's what is very much needed, I think, at least in this sector. You know that usually you can do many things, but trying to kind of be very, I don't know, I'm not managing to find the right word that defines that, but yeah, being good prioritizing and organizing your time to have impact, and maybe not to produce many things, but to focus on the outcomes and the impact, and not so much on the outputs, let's say, that you're producing.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point as well, being able to focus your time where you can have most impact rather than trying to do many, many, many things. Okay, focus on where you can do some things really, really well and have the impact that you really want to have within your organization, or more broadly, the impacts that your organization are having. So that's great advice as well. Thank you. So I wonder if you can tell us, Pat, some of the particular challenges that you're facing now in your work and some of the opportunities that you think are coming up within sort of the IUCN and more wider globally to do with sustainability in your role.
So we're trying in a way to work in a context where the ground is shifting all the time. So, you know, like as we go, there is new kind of like international frameworks or national priorities that are kind of like being defined. But at the same time, you know, when you're working in a specific project that are time bound and you work with a specific actor that have their own timings, it's very hard to try to kind of like feed the different timings, you know, in a way. So, you know, we have a very, very pressing issue. So we have a very ambitious 2030 and 2050 ambitions in climate and biodiversity. And we're developing programs to contribute towards these goals. But the timing sometimes are quite slow. And by the time that you manage to have something happening, then, you know, maybe it becomes slightly obsolete and maybe not so relevant as it was, you know, when it was thought 3-4 years before. So, so now we're trying to kind of like see how best we can, let's say, you know, work as flexible as possible, that we can, in a way, make all the things work as good together as possible, you know, like, so for instance, you know, there is, let's say, European programs, that are coming from Brussels, but they have their priorities, and then this is, you know, gets into some specific types of funding that then, you know, goes into specific projects that then we collaborate, you know? So, and this is in turn then going feedbacking back and defining policies that they're doing. So now, for example, they have created systems of, you know, institutional dialogue and trying to develop, you know, systems through which, let's say, the learnings from projects and informing policy is something that is happening at the same time and rather than at the end. So I think this kind of like trying to fit all this together, I think it's one of the challenges, you know. So, you know, another example, you know, like we're, you know, working now a lot on the climate agenda, no, and using nature-based solutions, for example, for mitigation, adaptation. And by the time that, you know, some of these, you know, to understand how and what it's more important to do and doing it, there is so many steps in the way that it's hard then to, you know, as I said, like, you know, okay, we can agree on what could be priority, but then, you know, like there's a lot of skill buildings to happen by the people that needs to be implementing it. And then it needs to be timed with specific funding that needs to be available for that at the time and the place that you want to do it. So So trying to kind of make all these things work, I think, is one of the challenges we are facing. And then the other one, and it's been linked with a previous inflection on work with economic sectors. So at the end, quite a lot of the work we're doing in terms of climate biodiversity, it's linked with different economic sectors that each one has their own structure, let's say. So for example, for us that we work in tourism a lot, it's a very atomized industry. There is a very few players that can represent the industry because there is so many small businesses, family-run businesses, middle-sized businesses, and then big hotel groups, big tour operators, mass tourism, more adventure, outdoor ecotourism operators. So there is such a wide range of stakeholders that sometimes it's hard to find the way to work with it in a consistent way. And people work in agriculture, sometimes it's similar. Now there is so many different ways that this industry is working, from industrial farms to kind of small producers. So trying to find ways in a way to work with the economic sectors coming from our type of organization, it's key, let's say, for change, but at the same time is what we are trying to address.
Yeah, it sounds extremely challenging. As you mentioned, the time scale was continually changing. Obviously, there are 2030 and 2050 goals, but every year we have a new climate COP and a new biodiversity COP, which adds new pressures. And we know the longer that we leave things and the longer, policies take and funding takes to come through, the shorter the actionable timescales we have to make the changes that we need to make to meet the global climate targets and biodiversity targets and things like that. So it does sound extremely challenging. I wonder if you can share perhaps a project that you're working on that you're particularly proud of, that you think is having real impacts and real difference in the Mediterranean or the areas that you're working in.
I think I was mentioning in the beginning about the project on ecotourism. So what we do there is at the end is trying to, there is always have been a gap, in predatory tourism that, the tourism industry doesn't know much about protected areas and conservation. They know it as an attraction, but maybe not as an ecosystem, no? And then sometimes, predatory area managers, they have a certain, sometimes, misunderstanding or mistrust in some of the industry, and so we have worked for I think 10 years now in trying to develop frameworks that there is collaboration between predator areas and local operators, and from here we have developed a series of interesting itineraries that are trying to tell us stories about predator areas in a multi-day tour. Have worked in Lebanon, in Spain, Italy, Northern Africa. I think managing to have this collaboration structure that in many cases have created that, the tourism operators are helping the partners of understanding demand, what people want, what potential tourists wants. And then this also allows the park when they work with their agro-businesses, not that they're involved in the park in producing honey or producing other type of produce that then can be sold. It helps this collaboration in a way to create this kind of territorialized or local, let's say, ecosystems, not that can work together in getting a sustainable models for tourism, for the area management and for products. And beyond this kind of quite intangible collaboration between these actors that in many cases haven't managed to collaborate so much in the past, we recently launched some of these products into the marketplace. So we are collaborating with Intrepid Travel, WWF Travel, Italy, and we're working with some other commercial partnerships. And we have managed in a way that these nice experiences and all these stories about these places, about the seeds in Crete, that have been one of the oldest seeds in the Mediterranean for some plants, or the stories about salt production in a protected area in a wetland. Now, some of the customers of these organizations are trying to have a positive impact, can be sold and people can go there. And we have seen recently, last year after COVID, the first trips happened, and we managed to kind of get some feedback from travelers that went to these places and had very positive reviews, let's say, you know, about the experiences, and especially I think they managed to capture a bit this the beauty of these places, no? And so I think that has been like this kind of project that you managed to kind of see the whole thing, you know, like from more the science, the policy, the implementation, the practices, and then you see like how this is translated into a tangible service experience that can go into the marketplace and then into the economic operators, and then, you know, like having an impact on an individual that then, you know, like goes back into the first place. So I think this is kind of like one of the, you know, the examples that you can see with the full picture, you know, of our work. And yeah, now that we need to evaluate, you know, in a couple or 3 years, you know, exactly, you know, like how many people there did these, you know, hotels and these small family run restaurants, you know, actually benefit from these, no? But so far, I think this is one of the things that, you know, like kind of like keeps you motivated and makes you proud of what you do.
Definitely. Sounds like a very rewarding project to be part of. And again, highlights that importance of engaging with different stakeholders and really listening to, you know, their needs, their understanding, and then communicating that with the other stakeholders to make sure that you've got everyone on board, that you're trying to meet everyone's best interests and everyone's needs so that everyone can collaborate for a successful project, so that everyone is sort of ticking the boxes of what they want to achieve in a positive fashion for the whole area, which is really important. So thank you for sharing that. That's a lovely example.
Okay.
And thinking now, I suppose, the opposite end of the spectrum, have there been any failures or projects or things that you've worked on that really haven't gone well or how you expected, and how have you learned from those?
Yeah, I think the main issue is that many cases, like funders and partners and even organizations, don't want to share that they are maybe not achieving what they were set off to achieve.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, like we'll be very good that there is a culture of people being a bit more open and honest about failures, about shortcomings. And, you know, maybe not thinking like in the past, for example, we were running for many years and it's still running and has been very successful, a sea turtle conservation project in Mayo Island in Cabo Verde. And for example, there were like many different aspects of the conservation problem that has, you know, like working with fishermen, you know, kind of like poaching issues around, you know, sun extraction to preserve the nesting habitats, the beaches. There were like many aspects of the project and many of them were successful. But for example, one that has always been very tricky is poaching. So for example, there is communities that have historically eaten turtle as one of the few resources that they had. And it was like a blessing, you know, like during the turtle season, they had a food resource that was very needed, you know, for centuries. Once, you know, like there is an understanding that there is other, you know, with imports and other ways, you know, to kind of explore agriculture and fisheries, that there is enough food, you know, there is not a need, no, but there is a tradition and there is a business around it, you know, like there is people willing to buy it, willing to enjoy it maybe once a year. So create an incentive for people to poach. So this is something that we obviously, you know, you can have as many guards as you want and rangers in the beaches, in the sea, but there is a point that if you don't attack one of the root causes, you will be always trying to kind of like play catch up in a way, no? So we set off to kind of like understand, you know, poaching, you know, like the economics around it, the anthropology behind it, you know, and the history. And we developed several initiatives, you know, from trying to work with young poacher, for example, that usually coming from maybe vulnerable position that they have a stable job or they had like some issue that they didn't allow us to kind of have an income. It's an economic issue. Maybe work with the demand, you know, like with people that wanted to do it, like how will you make them understand that, you know, like they can enjoy it in a different way, you know, like and maybe this doesn't have to be an essential ingredient for a party, let's say, to have it, no? And then to work also with the people, you know, sellers and, you know, wholesalers and, you know, like all kind of an industry that was done there informally. So we tried in many ways and many years. I think this program, I worked in it for 5 years. I think now it has been running maybe overall for 15. And I don't think we managed to reduce it, poaching, but still, if there is no one on the beach, probably that will be poaching again. And I would say like this one is one of these ones that obviously maybe 15 years after all the educational programs that have been happening with all the school children in the country, you know, like it's something that will change. But I don't know, like we know in, I think it's in Faroe Islands, no, that they have the pilot whale killing, or I don't know like exactly the name of the tradition to do it, that has been happening. And, you know, like, I don't think that's an issue of, you know, like, you know, global north, global south issue. I think it's in any context, you know, like how to achieve this type of long-term objectives. And there, I think we never finally managed to find the right key in a way. We did a lot of different things that I think contributed to it, but maybe never at the level that you would have liked. No, I think that was always something that, you know, I was thinking like, oh yeah, the desired future is a moment that, you know, like, it's not about less turtles poached, it's about like less people trying to poach them. No, you were talking about before, like things that you're proud of. I think this is kind of like the past, not the current, say a success story, let's say, but the nesting numbers went 50 times more, I think, after 15 years of this conservation program. So, you know, like from 700 to 15,000 nests. So,
yeah.
So it was very successful, but some of the things underlying it were never tackled at the level that you would have liked.
Yeah, I think you made some really interesting points there. So I think the time scales that you talk about, you know, a lot of sustainability is, it's the long game. You know, we're making changes or trying to make changes that could take 10, 15, 20 years or longer to implement and to see the actions that we want to see. And very often we charge into projects and want to see instant reactions and instant outcomes and impacts. And I think we have to remember that sometimes we need to be patient, and that, as you say, the education programs that are being put in place and the work that's being done with the different stakeholders takes time for that change to filter in, particularly if you're thinking about culture and different mindsets and emotions. Those are difficult challenges and difficult things to tackle if you've been growing up in a culture where these things are acceptable, and it has been that way for many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years. You know, why should you change? So thinking about the timescales with which the sort of sustainability experts are trying to work and have their impacts and measure and see those, I think, is a really important thing to consider. And again, how we address sensitively these cultural and emotional sides of the sustainability argument. So thank you for thinking about those. That's a really great point to raise. Do you have a sustainability hero? Was there somebody that inspired you to start your own sustainability journey, or perhaps an architecture hero? Because that's where you started out, wasn't it?
I never had any heroes. Talking about architects, I have to say, at some point when I was moving away, let's say, from, as I was mentioning, I worked in Barcelona and Switzerland for a while as an architect. And in London, I was doing more work related with, you know, sustainable travel in cities. And I was trying to kind of like move away and say, okay, like, what do you really want to do? And at some point, I started researching about, you know, architects that did different things. And funny enough, the creator or the person that put a name attached to ecotourism actually was an architect that started to work. It was a Mexican architect with Hector Ceballos that started to define the term, and to the first one to kind of develop this idea of maybe, you know, it's a tourism that, you know, needs by design, you know, to be educational, to provide a positive impact to the space that you're visiting, that it's providing a positive impact to the local communities you're visiting. And I find it, you know, inspiring, you know, that someone from a similar background came across that, no? And it's a sector that I have been working a lot. So it mentioned before about the imposter syndrome. This will be like kind of a very good vaccine in a way to that, no? In a way, trying to find people, you know, and then you finally come across many of them. Even the one of the, like the many people in a way that came up to define this term of a circular economy was also an architect, a Swiss architect, but also I think coming more from an idea of like the building process, no? In a way that we create new materials from raw materials, and then we use them for, I don't know, 20, 30, 100 years, sometimes, you know, several hundred in many cases, like not so much. And then we tear them down and then create new materials. So I think from many places you can find your role and the way to kind of contribute, no? And these two people were two of the people I came across that helped me say, okay, you know, there is not a specific credential that allow us to work in a sector or to develop yourself in a field or have your take, your own opinion. So I wouldn't call them heroes, but that maybe just people that have been inspirational or that has have a feeling packed, you know, like in your professional life. I just want to mention that I think, again, like not heroes, but for me that I spend a big part of the time I was transitioning, let's say, in my career in Cabo Verde, that's a place I have deep in my heart. It's 10 small islands in the middle of the Atlantic. I think like many people that I met there working, you know, on the field, working with fishermen, working with even some consultants, you know, that you come across. And I think you can find very inspirational people, you know, like in your day-to-day, in your life, like maybe sometimes even a farmer, a fisherman, even sometimes like politicians, you know, like you come across these people and, you know, it's kind of like amazing, you know, people that use their power and their capacity to inspire, not to move things forward. So I think I'll be more like taking bits and pieces, you know, from many people that you come across and you learn from them from a technical level, but also about like the way they do things and they approach things.
That's great. Everyday inspiration is an everyday heroes are a great one to be thinking about. And I wonder, you've been working in sustainability a long time now in different roles, in different countries, different continents. Have you noticed that the attitude to sustainability has changed in that time in the different fields that you've been working in?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I have the feeling, even when I was studying, you know, that this idea about green, eco, sustainability was this kind of like add-on, not to any sector, you know, that you say, okay, you do normal things and then you can also do this slightly better thing or a slightly different thing that is actually, you know, more sustainable. Whereas I have the feeling now that obviously there is some maybe outliers or some, you know, people that maybe don't feel that, but I think everyone is aware of this massive challenge that we have as society. And I think even like many of the major corporations are also aware of it in their risk management. And I have the feeling that there is a certain consensus, no, from, you know, community groups to politicians to businesses. Then the main issue is like how to go about it, no? And I think that's the challenge. But I think at least at the diagnostic level, I think now there is a much more awareness and much more understanding of the challenge that we have ahead. I understand also like that from these figures, you know, like I was saying before the Great December, but maybe Al Gore before her, you know, that also was someone that kind of like putting in the international agenda. But that's the thing that maybe keeps the motivation, no, and a kind of an optimistic, you know, light into situation. So we have very short time frames, very challenging, and maybe disagreements about how to go about it and the different pathways that we can take as societies, as countries, as sectors. But at least there is a common understanding. And I think from there, I think things will start to happen. I'm positive. Then, yeah, I don't know. Like there is many unknowns, but we have 30 years to figure it out. So we need to kind of like move ahead. No, the way like I think people in their 30s, their 40s, 50s are the ones that can especially have more impact right now, you know, for the next 10, 20 years. I think we have a certain obligation as well to try and do it.
Definitely. And do you have any final takeaway messages for young people that might be listening to this podcast that are interested to pursue a career or their passion in sustainability?
You know, I think that sustainability has to be the business as usual for the next decades. And kind of like sustainability, we can use like regenerative approach. I think there is many nuances in the world, no? But I think regardless of the way we specify the concept, you know, that thing that needs to be the business as usual, the normal. So I think I think in anything that you do, I think you can find your contribution to making our planet a place that we can live for the next 100-200 years, no? And I think that's kind of I think that's the main message. I think, like, you know, everyone has their role to play. I think that will be the main message.
Definitely, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Arnaud. Is there anything else you'd like to add to share with our listeners?
No, just thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my background. As I was mentioning, I maybe didn't explain it fully in the beginning, but yeah, I've been lucky to live in different countries and to work in different roles in different fields and in different sectors, you know, like third sector, private, public. And And yeah, I want to say, like, if you have a chance, you know, like, travel, and if you have opportunities, take them. And if it takes time to figure it out what you want to do, I think it's fine. I think, you know, like, you know, we all have like pressures to know what we want to do when we are 18, or we're 16, when we are 20. But sometimes, you know, you can figure it out, and when you're 30 or when you're 35, and, you know, so far as you're doing things that are, you know, you feel fulfilled and that you feel that you're contributing, and I think, you know, it's fine. One thing I had always kind of, I had this pressure, you know, on knowing what you need, what you want to do, and having very clear ideas, and maybe you don't know, and it takes time, and sometimes, you know, you need to change, and you, so I wouldn't worry about, you know, about this thing, you know? Sometimes, like, we have a pressure from families and from society that we need to figure things out, and obviously we need to, most of us need to work for a living, and it's clear that we need to score, but yeah, just to give each one time to develop, you know, their interest and find their call. It can come late in life, and that's fine. Something I would have liked someone to tell me at some point, you know, when you're 18 and you need to kind of like make decisions that they seem like, you know, for life when they're actually not, you know.
Well, sometimes you need to live the experience and have the opportunities come to you, don't you? Not everything comes to you as soon as you graduate or as soon as you finish school. You wait for the opportunity, and sometimes it doesn't arrive. So sometimes you have to explore and make those challenging decisions, be open to those opportunities. And the more opportunities you take, the more opportunities come to you. And sometimes that's how you find your passion.
Exactly. That's the other one. Like, if there are opportunities, usually take them. You know, you never know, you know, like this is kind of like very cliche, no, but you usually regret what you didn't do rather than what you did. And so when there is opportunities, I think in general, I think it's better to take them, even if they sort of be daring or challenging, but to go for it.
Definitely. Having a positive attitude and being open to opportunity. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Arnel, for sharing your time with us today and for sharing your insights into your sustainability career and profession. It's been wonderful.
Okay, thanks for having me. I hope it was useful, and it was nice to be here.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Arnel Tessier-Dorr. Episode hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare, organised by Kirsty Shakespeare and James Myers, music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org and join our online education community at tsl.earth. Thank you for listening.